I will.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening to one and all. Happy Shabbat. We're approaching Yom Kippurim. Hi, that sounds like that's JB's daughter.
Yeah,
I think so. Hi. that's really cute. I love it. I have a granddaughter, so trust me when I say I love it. That tone of voice that's a happy child is just, for me, absolutely captivating. My favorite sound in the whole world. JB, I'm going to do something here that is dangerous. If I get myself into trouble here, I'm going to apologize in advance. I've really just sat down. I was 2 days in a row. I was at flight school, and so I got back just in time to have a chicken pot pie with my wife, and then sat down. I had asked Kirk to do the observation show today, and he chose to do it on Yom Kippurim and to do it with Molly. Molly not only does a wonderful job of editing the chapters of observations, but she is instrumental in creating a children's version of Yad Yah, of understanding who Yahweh is from a teaching point of view that a child can understand. So she translates Yad Yah into child, which is extremely important. Yeah, absolutely. Get it from her. Post it. She is a gem. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to share my impressions of Yom Kippurim, just the top-level impressions. And it is very possible that I will contradict something that was said earlier. And if so, I'm not going to apologize, because I actually think that having different perspectives on things is valuable. We're not robots. Yahweh wants us to think. We are free to think. The purpose of the covenant is to liberate us, not to confine us. And also, it's important to have a full appreciation. There's a lot of things I've come to know, and I will say with absolute confidence, I know that for certain. And there's things that I will honestly say, these are my impressions, these are my conclusions, I could well be wrong. And I'm going to preface Yom Kippurim that way. My original impression of Yom Kippurim was that it had the Day of Reconciliations. We all resolve our any differences we have with Yahweh, so that we're prepared to camp out with him. Okay. I do not view that to be the case anymore. And I was always troubled by it, by why would we be reconciled after we were immortalized, perfected, adopted, enriched, empowered, and we became his troubadours, his messengers? Why would we be reconciled? That sounds like that's way after the fact.
Double reckoning?
Yeah. It's just, why would we be reconciled then? And slowly, I have come to the conclusion, and I don't want to use realization here, because I want to be completely open to criticism if you disagree.
Sure.
that I came to the conclusion that Yom Kippurim isn't about us. Not about us at all. I came to the conclusion that we would not know Yahweh if it wasn't for the promise he had made to others. That his return, his communication, his willingness to honor the terms and conditions of his covenant has nothing to do with us. No. And has everything to do with the promises he made to Abraham, to Jacob, to Yishak, I didn't say those in the right order, but to them. And if it wasn't for the promises he made to them, we wouldn't be here. He wouldn't return. He would never have bothered to fulfill the first four Mikra. And so I don't think Yom Kippurim has anything to do with us. I think Yom Kippurim is a celebration of Yahweh honoring the promises he made to Abraham, to Yishak, and to Jacob, and that we're just early beneficiaries of his promise. You know, along the way, we decided to take advantage of what he was offering them, and because he made a solemn promise to them, we are beneficiaries. We get adopted into the process. But I see Yom Kippurim is not the natural transition for us. For the natural transition for us is the covenant has five terms and conditions. It has five benefits. We meet the terms and conditions, and we meet and we receive the benefits through the first four Moed Mikra. We become immortal. We become perfected. We become adopted. We become enriched and empowered. And then, as his children, we are naturally inclined to be troubadours. And we have this natural aversion at that point to religion and politics, and we'll speak out against it, and a natural affinity for Yahweh's testimony. So we'll speak out in favor of it.
All right.
Those are the first five. But when it comes to Yom Kippurim, I think Yom Kippurim is all about Yisrael and Yahuda.
Well, that's always kind of
about Yahweh. Yeah, it's about Yahweh reconciling.
I mean, we're already set aside everything we could possibly want is in the first four.
Right. And we have the fun. The fifth is fun for us, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Patty were actually talking about that earlier this week because we've been trying to find more to actually do on the days to kind of teaching the tools for Glenn. Right. Yeah, I was on Kippurim, and I'm like, you know, it really is. It's the one that is really very much a Jewish thing. To me, it's kind of like it's something to look forward to. It's looking for us. It's looking forward to the return of the prodigal son. Where Yisrael
exactly.
is right now. They're the prodigal son estranged. We know they're coming back eventually, and we're looking forward to that.
Right.
But that's what it's for. It's them, not us.
Yeah. And with us, I think it is not a celebration on their behalf. It's a celebration on Yahweh's behalf to know how happy the Father is. That some of his children are going to return to him. So I see Yom Kippurim as us celebrating with the father in the prodigal son story. We're happy for Yah.
Absolutely.
And more I've come to this conclusion that Yah is so disgusted by Christianity. During these flight seminars, everybody I met was over-the-top Christian. Oh, and you know, and every time they'd say something, I'd just give them both barrels. I'd say, that's impossible. And you know, I'd say, you know, you can just throw away your Christian New Testament. There's little portions of Matan Yah that have some value to you, but they're so opposed to Christianity, if you read it with an open mind, you'd cease to be a Christian by the time you get to the fifth chapter, much less the seventh. And
I'm sure you're real popular.
Yeah, I think it might have some value if it had been maintained, but it hasn't. And there's no way to understand Revelation unless you read and understand Daniel and Zechariah and the other books. Well, what's your position on Jesus Christ? There is no such person. That's my position.
Wow. What did they say to that?
I said, yeah. The fact is, there wasn't an individual named Yahusha, but if you don't know his name, you do not know him. And oh, by the way, he was Torah observant. And they say, what about the New Testament? I said, it's trash. First, God is the same today as he was yesterday, as he will be tomorrow. There cannot be a New Testament. only one covenant. It's always singular. It's always specified as one. And the couple of times that Yahweh says that speaks of a second covenant, it's always that, what in the world are they doing? I will never have a second one. I'm angry at them for promoting a second one. So, no, what you have is trash. It's been so poorly maintained. It's completely untrustworthy. And the Pauline aspect of it is a complete contradiction of everything God said. You know, either Yahweh is right or Paul is right.
You're lucky somebody
was right. They can't right. Pardon? Oh, man.
Yahweh was wrong.
Paul was wrong.
That's right. I didn't go to that point, but yeah, I've said that. Do we agree? My flash truck, I was giving him both barrels. And, you know, we would talk about things. It was Don, and I said, I really do want to learn some of this stuff. I said, but I can't learn Hebrew. I said, I only need to learn Hebrew. What you have to do is buy an interlinear. You need to buy a Dead Sea Scrolls Bible so you know where the Masoretic differs. And then you need to buy at least three or four lexicons or Hebrew English dictionaries. And between those, I said, I've written a book to tell people how to proceed from there. I've written, these are the resources you should buy or access online. And once you hear it, here's Hebrew grammar. And I went through Hebrew grammar, and, you know, the relational stems didn't mean a thing to him. The volitional mood didn't mean a thing to him. Conjugations didn't mean a thing to him. But I said, there are no time tenses in Hebrew. And all of a sudden, dawned on him. So the Hebrew language is like God himself. Unchanging, always true. Yeah.
Yep.
So, well, you got that one right. Now, because of that, there can't be a New Testament. Oh. The other person, she said, I'm really up to speed on prophecy now because I just attended this conference, this woman evangelical preacher that's on television. I just went to her conference. Boy, I'm really up to speed on prophecy. I said, well, did she speak about the Moed Mikre? What?
What?
And you don't know anything about prophecy. Uh-huh. All of prophecy is based upon the Moed Mikre. It's all based upon the Planet 7. If she didn't discuss that, you've got no clue. Oh, see, but she talked about, Matthew 24, where they were talking about, how hurricanes would fit into that. So she translated megaseismos as moving to and fro, and she applied that to hurricanes and tornadoes. That's good. But who is it that's returning? Who are the birth pangs for? When is he returning? Didn't know any of that. So I understand Yahweh's point of view as it relates to Yom Kippur, but slowly it's come to my realization. Again, I'm not claiming to be right. You do the best you can with the information we have available, and JB and Kirk, your processes are the same as mine, which is we have access to the exact same information, access to the exact same tools, and based upon the words Yahweh conveyed, we assess what he said, and then we think about it, and we make conclusions based upon what we read. And it's my conclusion that had Yahweh not made the promise to Abraham, he would have nothing to do with humanity. He would not return. He would not have continued with the prophets. He would have just walked away from the whole sorry mess.
Yeah, we'd have self-destructed long before this.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think that Yahweh has slowed the self-destruct process down. And I don't think there's enough people listening to us to have any effect on self-destruct mode. But I've had now the opportunity probably to talk to 10 different people in the last few weeks, sharing why their faith in Christianity is absolutely unequivocally, demonstrably wrong, and proving it. And I've not had a single one of them respond positively or an open mind. Not one.
I believe so. Only thousands.
Yeah. So as I say, I think that Yom Kippur is not our celebration, other than it's our dad, and our dad is really happy about this day, and so I think we celebrate it simply by acknowledging how happy dad is that his wayward children have returned home.
Yeah.
And for Yahweh, the future is the past, is the present, so he can celebrate the return of his children at any time, because it's a fait accompli, although there just won't be that many of them. And I think, Kirk, there's also the possibility, and I've been more and more open to this, that those of us, like I think I'm Sioux Indian and Irish and a little English, there is a significant possibility that we just don't know, and that there may be more Yisraelite in us than we are aware of.
Certainly could be. I can't prove it, so it's academic because he doesn't care as long as we accept the terms and conditions. But it probably is a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of Celtic, there's a lot of Saxon, you know, and all those, we can trace those roots. So it says the likelihood that there's some in our bloodstream, certainly.
Yeah. And they were an advantage to people. So they were more likely, not less likely, to have children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were clearly an advantage to people. Yisraelites and Yehudim have always been smarter. That's why there's so much jealousy against them. So they were a smarter people. So it is certainly possible. I think it matters, but only in one respect. I'm delighted to be adopted. You know, I am never going to measure up to Dod or to Moshe or to Yashaya or any of the people that Yahweh from Yehuda has chosen to convey his message. I'm not in competition with them. If I were, I would lose badly, and quite frankly, I don't want to be, and I don't want to be at their level, because their level comes with a responsibility that I just don't want to have. I'm looking forward to sneaking in the door, and playing golf and having fun while I'm there. I want it to be fun, and I'm sure it'll be fun for them. But there comes a responsibility. Dod carries a tremendous responsibility, as does. That's why when Dod failed on the three questions that was stated, why there was such a tremendous consequence. You know, with what he knew and how he was chosen, there is a tremendous responsibility. I don't think we have a responsibility. I think we have an opportunity. And the opportunity is tremendous. And I think should we choose to engage in the opportunity, we have a responsibility to be as accurate and forthright as we can possibly be. But it isn't at the same level of...
we're not as hard. We're just studying.
No. No. So... Anyway, those are my thoughts on Yom Kippur. You guys want to challenge me?
No, I don't think this is true.
I agree completely.
Yeah. We're returning to see the show and enjoying the fact that we're going to be returning to see it all and see that happy day that's so important to him. So, yes, absolutely. That's not as close to me.
Yeah, I see Sukkah as when Yahweh gets to return to Yisrael, he reestablishes his home built out of light. He establishes that bridge of light over the existing Temple Mount, because his home is going to be built on the summit. I think Dod's home will be a home of light that will be right below it. The bridge will connect the two, and that we will be six-dimensional constructs or seven that are able to enjoy all of it. And I think that if we were, even if we were Yehudim or Yisraelite, I think that the fact that we became part of the covenant prior to the tribulation, I think that we're just going to be spiritual beings at that point. So I think that the responsibility of the tribulation as it relates to, not the tribulation, but the thousand-year celebration of Sukkah, I think it's the mortals.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the 1 in 10 that survive it, that are Yisraelite, I think they're the mortals that will have responsibility. I think the rest of us will just go out and have fun. But, you know, we'll see. We're not told everything.
You're right. That sounds good.
Yeah. You know, I was translating 3 days ago before I did the flight school stuff, and I came to a passage that was talking about the nature of translation. And in written communication. And one of the things that was really interesting is that one of the verbal roots of the word conveyed that that our that Yahweh was calling out. He said, "Look, I'm looking for witnesses." And one of the nature of the criterion, you know, was Aman, obviously. They, you know, I want somebody that's going to be truthful and forthright and reliable and dependable and steadfast and the like. But an aspect of it was also artistic. And, of course, first thing I thought of was Kirk and artistic. But I also thought about the thing that we've talked about a lot. I think that translating is an art form. You know, I have
That element to it.
Yeah, I think so. And I've talked about this before, that if you just look at the lexicons are predisposed to convey a religious definition of every word,
yes,
which is obedience-oriented, faith-oriented, religion-oriented. And I have exactly the opposite predisposition. Mine is the extreme on the other side. Mine is that, you know, having come to know what Yahweh expects, what he's offering, who he is, I have come to the predisposition that every time you see a word, if there's a range between religious and obey and freedom and no, I automatically go to the far extreme of liberation, of opportunity, of free will, of relationship. And so that's a choice. You know, that's a perspective, and like an artist, you choose the perspective that you think best fits. And you know, I realize that's my predisposition. And is there a possibility my perspective is wrong? Sure. You know, because it's in conflict with the vast, overwhelming majority of scholastic tools to take this, consistently take the freedom, relational, guidance, teaching, direction aspect of all of this as opposed to law, obey, you know, angry God that wants to punish. So I think there is a some artistry. I mean, I know that some of those, we came up with last week I sent out an email to a number of people and said, look, you know, I'm here trying to translate, and I think it was Yeshayah 7, the end of it. And
18 and 25.
Yeah, 18 and 25. And I said, yeah, it's all poetic language. And he's obviously not going to take out this giant razor and shave the feet of mercenaries. So,
no.
A literal translation of it just isn't going to work. So, you know, I would love to, you know, get some input as to what people think. And you know, I just couldn't set it down. So over the next 2 days, you know, I gave what I thought was happening. But, I mean, I'm stretching the full meaning and the potential meaning of every word as far as it can be stretched. And so, yeah, it's that's the artistry in the whole thing. And the more you extrapolate, the higher chance it is that you could be wrong. But I felt that since I was talking about the last days, and he's using a near time event to speak about what's going to occur, I thought it was incumbent upon us to try to figure it out so that it can be of value to Yehudim during the last days.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that where he speaks in poetic parables, and you don't share a word picture if you want the message to be very clear cut and succinct, and you don't share a word picture if you don't want people to figure it out. So if addressing an issue, if Yahweh or Yosha didn't want us to know, they would not share a parable. They just wouldn't say anything. But if they wanted to make knowing simple, they wouldn't share it as a parable. So the moment you deal with artistic language and symbolic language and parables, you automatically, logically know two things. One is that God wants us to figure this out, or he wouldn't have said anything.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, that figuring it out is not going to be a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's designed so that most people won't figure it out, but thoughtful people will.
Yeah. He's made it a challenge. Actually, it's fun.
Yeah, I think so. And it gets all into this idea, like the Christian was talking about. Yeah, he said, you know, well, you know, if you know, you take Paul out in salvation by grace, then how are you saved? What is the what's the remedy for sin? Well, when you look at when you look at the story the correct way, you realize that salvation is essentially irrelevant. Our Yahweh's goal is not to save us. Salvation is simply a byproduct of us being in his family.
Right.
Protect their children.
Yeah.
Protect their children. His goal is to immortalize us so we can enjoy the relationship for a long time, to perfect us so we can spend it in his presence, adopt us so that our relationship is father-son or father-daughter, and then enrich and empower us so that we can walk shoulder to shoulder, side by side, and journey through the universe together. That's what he's offering. If you don't want that, then you ought not ask God to save you. You're really asking something that's wholly and completely inappropriate. Don't ask God to save you. Don't expect him to save you. And don't celebrate your salvation. Celebrate the fact that you're engaged in a relationship with him. Very hard concept for the Christian to process. That it's not about salvation. Well, then how does he do it? I said, Moed Mikre, peace on. Being immortal.
You put it before. You asked him, you know, what are you being saved from, and what are you being saved to? Isn't that important to know, or just being saved?
Yes. Right. And why would you want a God to save you that you don't even know?
Was Jesus Christ terrified of hell because of their
was no
their distinct approach of religion?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, you only want to be saved.
They just don't want to go to hell.
That's correct. You have no idea what heaven's about. No concept whatsoever. So it was an interesting discussion, and this the next statement from Yeshaya 5:12 just fits into it perfectly. Regarding that which is achieved, after expending considerable energy to provide recompense by Yahweh, they do not have any regard for it. They don't even consider it or seek to understand it, nor the work or pursuits of his hands, neither seeing nor understanding, no longer observant. My single greatest anguish is knowing how Yahweh not only explained the means he was going to have to resolve our issues that would have kept us out of being empowered to the seventh dimension and spending eternity with our Heavenly Father, that he not only explained how the five terms and conditions of the covenant present us in a position where we can accept those gifts, but that he specifically outlined a plan through the Moed Mikre at great personal expense to himself. Stunning personal expense to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that 99.999% of the world piss on him.
Yeah.
Take a dump right there on top of it. I want to be graphic here because that's what they're doing. With the celebration of Christmas and Easter and Sunday worship and Ramadan and a complete aversion to Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot. They're spitting in God's face. And if I were God, tell you what, that would upset me a lot. to have done all this, to have articulated it, and to have man try to appease him through these disgusting religions that all completely ignore and disregard and actually despise what he's offering and what he did at great personal expense. So I think that Yeshaya 5:2 is riveting in terms of explaining why God is so upset with religious and political men.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding that which is achieved, after expending considerable energy to provide recompense by Yahweh, they do not have any regard for it. They don't even consider it or seek to understand it, nor the work or the pursuits of his hands, neither seeing nor understanding, no longer observant. That's what I think bothers God more than anything else, is that man is completely immune, completely ignorant of, has absolutely no consideration whatsoever for what he has done for us.
And willfully ignorant.
Willfully ignorant, and worse, has created these elaborate religious
myths.
Myths to replace the reality of what he's done. And if I were God, he would really upset me. I would have no interest in them. People that pray, thinking that he's going to answer their prayers when they have completely ignored everything he's had to say. So he says, as a consequence, my people are exposed and vulnerable, revealed for who they really are, stripped of any pretense, exiled many as captives because of their lack of knowledge and discernment, their ignorance and inability to understand, resulting in their inability to distinguish between right and wrong, and their unwillingness to discriminate between good and bad. God does not say, you know, I'm really upset with them for their lack of faith. I'm upset with them for their lack of devotion. I'm upset with them because they're not worshiping me.
No. They're not praying ceaselessly.
Right. No. I'm upset as a consequence of the fact that my people have become vulnerable and revealed themselves for who they really are. And they are exiled from me, estranged from me, because of their lack of knowledge and discernment. The two words for that is that they are ignorant, they lack knowledge, and they are irrational. They're incapable of reasoned thinking, of exercising good judgment. Their ignorance and ability and inability to understand discriminate between good and bad, right and wrong.
So why is the Neshama just not working? Is it just years and years of just beating it down, or... Or they just don't care.
Well, I think that the two things, I think I'm going to list three. I think there are three things that are absolutely deadly to an Neshama. One of those is inactivity. And in political correctness, the Neshama is inactive. It is sidelined. There is no judgment. I had a presentation today with a guy that manages a large section of the country for the FAA and air traffic control. And he says there's a significant difference in the last 20 years with the people we've hired. Because of the unions, I can't discipline them and I can't fire them no matter how egregious their behavior is. They can beat their wives, beat their girlfriends, show up every day overdosed on drugs, have a crappy attitude. Doesn't matter. I cannot fire them because of the government. And no matter what we instruct them and say, you know, if the conditions of your employment, these are the things that are expected of you, they could care less. They say, so what are you going to do, fire me? Says there's the act of exercising good judgment amongst the people for the last 20 years that have come through the indoctrination process that we call the education system, mm-hmm. is that it has rendered them incapable of exercising good judgment. So I think political correctness causes the nasama to be unused. And, you know, an unused muscle atrophies and has no value. If you do not use your brain, you lose the discipline of that goes along with thinking. The second is that religion and politics are both immune, allergic to evidence and reason. They're adverse to evidence and reason. So if you're political or you're religious, you for example, when I told the flight instructor mm-hmm. that there were more discrepancies between the 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts of what's called the Christian New Testament than there are words by almost two times between them and the Textus Receptus, and that it is wholly and completely unreliable. I said, you know, you sound like a messianic that told me when you turn to this thing, New Testament, just rip it out. And I said, I think you misspoke there because the messianic tries to blend Pauline Christianity with the rabbinic Judaism, and you're blending two wrongs, and that does not make it right. But the fact is that it's a wholly and totally unreliable text, and he could not even process. And it was just, no, his faith would not allow him to go there. And we talked about that. Well, what about the Septuagint? I said, do you have any clue that the myth that 70, much less 72, elders created it for Ptolemy, and that whole myth circa 250 BCE is wholly and completely false? And that the oldest fragment is only like an eighth of one chapter of one book of the Torah. And that's all we have that even dates to around 100 BCE. And that the first even marginally complete Septuagint dates to almost 400 CE. Are you aware that by the second century it was so divergent and so many variations that Origen spent his whole life trying to reconcile them? No, not aware of any of that. And how can you, tout a book you don't know the history of? Yeah, why would you tout and defend a book you don't know the history of? So, faith causes people to discard information through logical fallacy, whether it be ad hominem, or through just pure ignorance, or inability to be rational. So I think those are reasons. And then the other reason is that if you are patriotic, in fact, the new litmus test in America is very quickly becoming, I would never have thought that in a million years, but allegiance to country, to military, and to flag is becoming the new litmus test in America. You know, you are not fit to be an American unless you salute the flag and respect the flag and respect the troops. And even those that are doing the protest, they'll come out and say, "Oh, we honor our troops. We appreciate their sacrifice, and we don't discount the flag. And, you know, we're patriotic." And they were just protesting social justice. That's the new litmus test. And so, to be part of the covenant, to accept what Yahweh is offering, is ostracizing. Most people don't want to be ostracized. I think those are the three reasons that a decision that causes you to be ostracized is unacceptable to people, even if it means they have to knowingly cling to lies. I remember 2 weeks ago I was at this party and we're talking about Paul, and I said, do you have any idea what the thorn in Paul's side was? He says, no, I just never understood. I said, some people have guessed it because he was a homosexual. And I said, he really was a homosexual. I said, oh, man, that would make a lot of sense. I said, no. He tells you what the thorn in his side is. Have you ever read the conclusion of the sentence?
Yeah. Finish the sentence.
Right, yeah. Yeah, finish the sentence. He says the thorn in his side is a messenger, which would be a malach, from Satan. That's a demon. He was demon-possessed. Incapable of even processing it. It just like, you know, I told him, you know, ice cream is cold. What do you think?
Yeah, okay.
They honor and attribute high status. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah, go away. You're bothering me. They honor and attribute high status to, respecting the reputation and abundance, the popularity and manifestation of power, especially the overall societal acceptance of the ravenous and insatiable maggots of men, the lowly and insignificant humans who are parasitic louses. So their capacity for compassion and ability to enrich their abundant mercy and the galleries of people with enormous inheritance has shriveled up and evaporated. So it isn't just that as few as 1 in 1 million people are actually aware of what Yahweh has done, of how he expended considerable effort to reconcile us. It isn't just that those people, therefore, are exposed and vulnerable because they're ignorant and irrational. The third aspect of it is that they have actually established religious and political schemes where they have, attribute high status. You got to respect the office of president. You have to respect the religious leaders. You got to respect somebody's religion. You need to respect the flag. You need to respect our troops. They honor and attribute high status to respecting the reputation, abundance, the popularity, and manifestation of power, especially the overall societal acceptance of scumbags. That's mm-hmm. the ravenous and insatiable maggots of men. Of slime balls. Of lowly and insignificant humans who are parasitic louses. So it's not just that Yahweh is not known. It's not just that what Yahweh has done is unknown. It's not just that the people are exposed and estranged from him because of their inability to be reasonable. It's that they've actually replaced God. Their government is their source of protection. Their government is their source of security. Their government is their source of freedoms. Their religion is their salvation. They've replaced God. Now, when you take the time to really understand what the words mean, Yahweh is a very effective, very complete, very passionate, very relevant communicator. And now when you do that, what happens? Well, mankind was offered the ability to experience compassion, mercy, the ability to be enriched, the gift of the ultimate inheritance, the entire universe, everything Yahweh has to offer by becoming his children. What happens when you honor and attribute high status to humans and the human institutions? You squander all of that. It shrivels up and evaporates. As a result, there is an enormous opportunity, a wide open, broadened, and enlarged opening for improper and greedy boasts of Shaul's soul. He has opened his mouth to speak, parting it wide to impart words beyond measure, and without thinking, for the purpose of negating the word, without ceasing through corrupt inscribed decrees and invalid conditions for living. Now, Yahweh went directly to the greatest scoundrel of all time. And what he's saying is that because men were worshiping men, that's why Romans, was it 13, where he goes into all governments have been established by God and that you should submit to them. That's why... That's why people bought into that, even though it's directly contradictory to what God said. They honor and attribute high status to these slime balls. Now, they believe their pope. They attribute high status the maggots of men. And as such, between being wholly ignorant of what God has done at tremendous cost, failing to understand it, failing to exercise any discernment, and then attributing high status to humans and human institutions, it created the opportunity for Paul, for Shaul. That's what created the opportunity. And it's why there's such a broad path to the plague of death. Now, in that statement, too, we also find that we have another example of Yosha saying nothing new. You know, he talked about the broad path that leads to death, and many there are that find it. And that's what's being said here. Right. And he will even go in to say that it's the wolf in sheep's clothing, the Benjamite. It's only two Benjamites of any consequence, and there's only one that would be meaningful to his audience, which would be Shaul, the only Benjamite from that time forward that is known. And he called him lowly and little, and specifically said that the problem is going to be negating the Torah and referring to me as Lord. I'm going to keep you all out of heaven, and I'm going to say I don't know you. And so he's citing what we're reading right here. It was, and I want to make certain that I convey this appropriately. I'm the last thing from an anti-Semite. I love Yahweh's chosen people for lots of reasons. Even when I was back in the days that I worked, my Jewish customers were always my favorite, by far, overwhelmingly. I had great Jewish friends. I dearly love Yisrael, but my appreciation of these things is really that I've striven to have my perspective reflect Yahweh's perspective. Yisrael is near and dear to Yahweh's heart, it's near and dear to my heart. Why? Because I like Yahweh. I want him happy. I want to speak in favor of those things he speaks in favor of. I want to help those he seeks to help. And so as you realize this, that said, the reason that Shaul, who was a Israelite, the tribe of Benjamin, was successful is because Israelites did such a lousy job. They were given this message. They were given every opportunity by Yahweh. Yahweh proved that he could be trusted. Every positive thing that could possibly be done in their favor, Yahweh did in their favor, and they turned on him. Yeah. Paul would not have succeeded if it hadn't been for religious Jews. They're the ones that hid his name. They're the ones that replaced his Torah with their Talmud. They're the ones that turned the relationship into a religion. So, the opportunity was created by Jews and then taken advantage of by Gentiles. So, the status, productive nature, and outstanding aspects of Jerusalem will decline and be abandoned, along with her capacity for compassion, abundant mercy, and ability to enrich, in addition to those joyously reveling and celebrating in her. Jerusalem was the source of reconciliation. That's what the word means. Jerusalem is Yahweh's favorite place on earth. Jerusalem is where he met with Abraham. It's where he established Dode's home. It's where he revealed most of his message. And yet, what happened following Pauline Christianity is that Jerusalem became irrelevant. It was Rome. And soon it would become the Vatican. And Jerusalem was no longer the place where there would be joyous celebrations. And the capacity for compassion and mercy and the ability to enrich that flowed out of everything that was said and done there was nullified. Because everything that was important about Jerusalem and what it stood for and what transpired there was usurped and replaced by religion. Later, by politics.
Oh, this is a first. Excuse
me. Wow. Yeah. So man bows down in submission. I mean, again, you take the time to convey these words, and it is a progression. What is the next progression? So man bows down in submission. Man is humiliated and subjugated as each individual is brought down and abased. And the eyes, the perceptions and perspectives, even the appearance of the high and mighty, the proud and exalted, immoral high officials and powerful people are lowered, brought down and humbled, deprived of status. You know what a dead king looks like?
A maggot filled and the other dead body?
Yeah. It goes from a maggot-infested corpse to ashes. You know what a dead general looks like?
Same thing.
Same thing. You know, a dead pope, you know what a dead pope looks like?
Same thing.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a combination of two things. One is that, and this is the most amazing thing that I've found about Pauline Christianity, besides the fact that it's just a whole, that the whole proposition is irrational, is that Paul condemns the Torah for being a cruel taskmaster and how it's the law that has to be obeyed, none of which is true. And then he presents his gospel as you either submit to him or you're damned.
Yeah.
You know, the Roman Catholic Church claimed to be,
vicar on earth.
God's vicar here on earth. And they have their church canon, and you either submit to them or they'll kill you. They'll torture you. And they will condemn you. So those that claimed that they had created this this means to liberate you from the cruel taskmaster of the Torah actually took you away from the ultimate source of liberation and imposed a enslaving religion. The ultimate hypocrisy. And so once Roman Catholicism was established by Theodosius in 400 CE, man bowed down in submission. Man was humiliated. That was the feudal system was imposed by Theodosius. Man was subjugated. Each individual was brought down, abased. And not only were the masses forced to bow down in submission and humiliated, but to those that were subjugating them were ultimately brought down, deprived of status. There is, you know, these kings and these popes may think, wow, you know, I now have this monument to me and I had all the status and I'm in the history books. No, they're worm rot.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute worm rot. And so that is what God's saying. Now, 5:16 is where we had not covered, so let's turn to the fully amplified version of it. Then Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual implements. So Yahweh uses Sabah regularly. And, I did not understand that. I'm not positive I have it right now, but my conclusion is why he refers to himself as Yahweh, Sabah, of the Sabah, the vast array of spiritual implements, the command and control regime of heavenly messengers and envoys, is because as a seven-dimensional entity, he cannot enter a lower dimension. And the only way he can interact with a lower dimension is through implements. And so the Shaba, which are comprised of Malak, are implements. Now these are energy-based beings, light-based beings, that can interact in our 3.5D realm. But Yahweh himself can't enter 3D, much less 4D, 5D, or 6D. of the seven-dimensional construct. So I think he presents himself that way because that's how he protects us. Mm-hmm. That's how he conveys his message to us. That's they play a very essential role. They're the tools. They're very much like Walt Disney's pencils and brushes.
Creating,
yeah. So then Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual implements, the Shabbat, will be genuinely and continually exalted with regard to the means to exercise good judgment and resolve disputes. Now, why is it he says then Yahweh will be exalted? What just happened? The high were brought down. Man was subjugated, and man has been subjugated for, you know, the better part of the last 3,000 years, maybe more in some places. But after man is subjugated, after the leaders themselves are humbled, the next thing is that Yahweh will be known for who he is. He will be exalted, not man. He will be continually and genuinely exalted. That has not happened yet. That is in our future. Yahweh will be elevated in position and dimensions, assigned the highest possible status with regard to the means to exercise good judgment and resolve disputes. So, here it's not Yahweh saying, oh, you know, praise be me. Praise God in the highest. That's not what he's saying here. What is that Yahweh is going to be continually and genuinely exalted for a specific thing. Not for who he is. Oh, that's praiseworthy, but, you know, he's not interested in that. What's going to be exalted, what's going to be accepted at the highest possible level, isn't who Yahweh is. That's not what he's asking for here. But instead, what he has done for us. The mitzvah, with regard to the means to exercise good judgment and resolve disputes. We're going to come to a time where we value Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shavua, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. We're going to come to a time where we're going to value the original terms and conditions and benefits of the covenant. And we're going to value the author of those things. And the Almighty, the set-apart one, will show himself prepared and dedicated to serve by being right, tzedakah. I have said many times, and I've not heard much pushback on this, so I think in this group it is something that is accepted, or if you go outside of this group, it would be demeaned. Not only doesn't God want to be worshipped, not only is God opposed to being worshipped, he's actually extraordinarily humble.
Yes.
What he's saying here is that I am ready to serve you. You know, I said this, it came to my attention when I was translating Barak back a long time ago in Bar Rishit, that Yosha is really God on his knees. That God's idea, the proper perspective, is him getting down on his knees to lift us up, not us getting down on our knees to lift him up. That us getting down on our knees to lift him up is not only useless, counterproductive, and it's grotesquely arrogant of us. It's stunningly demeaning of Yahweh to think that he would create a being to worship him in that regard. But it's absolutely contrary to what a father would want a child to do in a family relationship, and it is entirely contrary to what God said. His intent is to get down on his knees to lift us up. Once you have that perspective, your relationship with God, your view of God, changes dramatically. What this says is that God is prepared and devoted to serving us. Not us serving him. Him serving us. Even when we try to work with him, we get more out of it than we put into it. And how is Yahweh going to serve us? By being right. By being correct, by being truthful, by being trustworthy, by acquitting us the correct way. Now, I used to have a tough time with, back in the day, we had another person who was participating in this program. He never understood why God had to endure Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. Why did God endure those things? You know, couldn't he have just said, hey, you know, my idea is for you to be just like me, and you be part of my family, and welcome. Couldn't do that. Wouldn't be right. To overlook a grievance isn't fair. It's being capricious. So God had to figure out a way that he himself could pay the price for our failings. And so what he did on Pesach and Matzah made it possible for us to be right with him. So what God wants us to recognize is that he is prepared and dedicated to serve us, but the right way, not capriciously. He's not going to capriciously save somebody. He's not going to capriciously answer somebody's prayer to enrich them or to have somebody fall in love with them or whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. It's not going to happen that way. But he is dedicated to serve us. And the key aspect of all of this, so that's the thing that struck me about Dodd. Dodd wasn't good. Dodd was right. Yahweh said Dodd was right. And he said, he is my son, I am his father. So it tells, and he even told us that King Shaul was good. King Shaul was not right. Shaul was condemned by Yahweh and is dead, estranged from him, even though he was very, very good. In fact, Yahweh says, there was nobody who was, excuse the English, more good. But that's what it says. More tov, had greater tov than King Shaul. He was the perfect exemplar of good. Dodd was the perfect exemplar of right. Dodd was the antithesis of good. Shaul, King Shaul, was the antithesis of right, but he was the exemplar of good. And so, like when I was telling somebody, we were talking about, I said, well, you don't need religion. You just need to live a good life. I just tell people, live a good life. So, King Shaul lived a good life. He's not only dead, he's expressly condemned by God. You know, I thought about today, I was flying, I don't know what caused me to think about it, but I've always wondered, okay, why was the king and the wannabe apostle named Shaul? And why does that mean question him? And why is the place named Sheol? And why is the individual named Shaul? Well, I came to the understanding, okay, Shaul means to question. We should question what Paul said. We should question what King Shaul did. But why is the place of eternal separation from God called essentially question him?
Well,
what do you think?
Eternal questioning? I mean,
that's what I thought.
The place
I don't
put
think that's
guys.
The case anymore.
Why did I do this? Why did I go wrong?
That's what I originally thought. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think that's the best answer anymore. I think there's a better answer.
Okay.
If you're being questioned by God, you're being judged by God. If you're being judged by God, guess where you're going?
To
100% of those who are questioned by God end up in Sheol.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So if you are among those who are being questioned, you're going to Sheol. Yeah, there is no reason that Yahweh would awaken those who whose souls are just simply fading into oblivion or no longer going to exist, which is the vast majority of people. He's not going to question them. It would be cruel. It would be unfair to awaken them and say, oh, by the way, you screwed up. Here I am now. I'm going to put you into a perpetual coma here. That would be unnecessary. It would be cruel. It would serve absolutely no purpose. It's wholly inconsistent with God's character. Ain't going to happen.
No.
So if
their souls were mortal, and they died when the body died.
Right. If you're like King Saul or the wannabe Apostle Paul, and you're being questioned, it's over for you. 100% of those who are judged by God end up in Sheol. No exceptions. If you're part of the covenant, you're not judged. You're not questioned. If you are not part of the covenant, but not actively misleading people, your soul just ceases to exist. It's not awakened to be questioned. If you're judged, if you're being questioned, you're going to Sheol. Question him. I think that's why it's called Sheol, place of questioning. 100% of those who are questioned end up there. All right, so Yahweh now is, has said that people are going to have a high regard for his willingness to do the right thing on our behalf and to resolve our disputes. They're going to have a high regard for that. And it says, then the lambs shall be shepherded and cared for. When we trust Yahweh as the source of our reconciliation, if you will, then he becomes our shepherd. Then the lambs will be shepherded and cared for. They'll be able to graze appropriately in their pasture. You know, our pasture right now, from Yahweh's perspective, I'm going to extrapolate here. If we were Rachel Yehudim, our pasture is Yisrael. And when Yahweh returns, Yisraelites will be able to pasture in their God-given realm, Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
As Gentiles, prior to him returning, I think we have a different pasture. Where do you think our pasture is right now? Not in heaven, because we're not there.
No. Well,
it's right in your face, and yet it's not immediately obvious. It's right in our face, and yet it's not intuitive or obvious. Where is our pasture now? Where are we shepherded? Where are we cared for? Where do we graze? That's a heck of a clue there. Where do we graze?
The Torah.
Yeah, the Torah, prophets, and psalms.
Oh,
his word.
Yeah.
Our pasture is his word.
That alone, Dave.
Torah, prophets, and psalms. Yeah, I spent today in airplane school. It's the first time I've done this show in a very long time where I just sat down and I did not read through and think about what the material we're going to go over.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this is the first time I've ever had that thought to realize where is our pasture. So, Yahweh's words are inspiring. We're constantly able to learn from them. And sometimes when we haven't done all the preparation and we're just saying, I'm pretty reliant here now. Let's work together on this. You pick up things you never would have otherwise seen. But, it's not just been a long day. I've been doing this for 15 years. The first time it dawned on me that there is a pasture other than Israel. It's his word. Ultimately, our pasture is going to be the universe. And there'll be a time when the pasture is Israel again. For right now, our pasture is his word. So the lambs shall be shepherded for and be able to graze appropriately in their pasture. And among the ruins of places deserted by the fat ones who are wiped out, they shall gather together as invited guests, and they shall be nourished. The remnant of Israel is going to gather in places that have been wiped out. They're going to gather, where the sheiks and all of the wealthy, money-grubbing Muslims have built their places, where the Roman Catholic Church was another money-grubbing institution.
Samaria,
you hear about the fact that the Roman Catholic Church, after 2,000 years, probably 1,600 years, has been a Roman Catholic Church, that after 1,600 years, they finally employed, for the first time ever, an auditor for the Vatican Bank. And so the first time ever they have an auditor for the Vatican Bank. 2 weeks ago, they not only fired him, they besmirched him. And he finally came out.
How they communicated.
Yeah, what he said is, I found a lot of irregularities. I found a lot of things that were just wholly inappropriate, and I brought my findings to the higher ups in a long dossier intended for the Pope. And when they saw what I had found, they fired me. You know, the Roman Catholic Church is a money-grubbing leech.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the ruins of these deserted places of the fat ones that are wiped out, they shall gather as invited guests. Now, I've said a lot of times, I don't want to go back to Yisrael until such time as Yahweh cleans house.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And once he does, it's a different story. But okay, let's think about his word now as isn't Yahweh's testimony the absolute ruin of every cleric and king?
Of course.
Yeah, it's a place where every cleric and king is destroyed. Their credibility is absolutely trashed, and so. We too
have a military leader. They don't have a military. So, right. General, same thing.
Yeah, don't have one. So that brings us to Yeshaya 5:19. This is a long statement. I'll read it all the way through, and then we'll dissect it here. It says, "Whoa!" So this isn't really the start of another thought. Whoa! This is a warning. To those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting, in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futility, and vanity. And with the ties that bind on a harness of a cart of sin, the one among them says, without thinking and out of anxiety over the future, he should want to hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may see it. So let the vexing counsel, the painful advice and scheming plan of the Holy One of Israel approach and present itself, because we want to be made aware and to know. Now, there's a ton of stuff going on here. The first is, when Yahweh says, oi, that ain't good. You do not want to be the recipient of an oi. That means a laugh. This disastrous and destructive situation can ruin a person. This is a cautionary tale. Whoa. Oi. You know, you've heard the Yiddish oi vey? Yeah, well.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, oi. Who is he warning? The dupes that were played for fools or fleeced by religion, is he warning those who have bowed down in submission? Nope. Whoa, this is a warning to those who take the lead in promoting. I've said this lots of times, but Yashaya has his own vocabulary. It's at least a one out of every three or four words in Yashaya is found no place else. You know, Mashak is not one of those terms we find elsewhere. Mashak is a Yashaya term. It means those who take the lead to promote, those who draw up, carry out, and advance something. These are political leaders. These are religious leaders. He's talking now about Paul, Muhammad, Akiba, Theodosius, popes, rabbis, those who take the lead in promoting what? A wrong.
Error.
Wrongdoing, wickedness, perversity, depravity, iniquity, warping the message. A wrong means to warp, to twist, and to distort. We have talked about this so many times, but virtually all of the world's major religions did not create their religion out of whole cloth. Even the scientific magic of the Church of Scientology, what do they call themselves? The Church.
Mm-hmm.
They're in all of the trimmings of Christianity. Do you think that Christianity was created by Paul out of thin air?
No.
He claimed Yahweh's credit. He claimed to be Yahweh's guy. He cited the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, although erringly, and twisted its message. All of these guys, even Muhammad, he claimed that his Quran affirmed the Torah. He claimed that his God, Allah, was the God of Esau, which he didn't know that Esau was the person that God called out to hate, but he identified Esau with the Christian Jesus.
Yeah.
He created his lie by perverting the truth. Judaism's Talmud is an argument against the Torah. Arguments on the Torah. Rabbinic Judaism isn't a creative lie. It's a distortion or a perversion of the truth. Christianity isn't an outright lie. It's effective because it perverts and twists the truth. It's why when I can tell this individual that from the perspective of Yahweh, salvation isn't the goal, it's relationship, and they still say, well, it sounds like salvation to me. Because the lie of Christianity developed its credibility by perverting and twisting the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what God's angry about. I don't think God would care if a person like Buddha, for example. I think God could give two hoots about Buddha. If Buddha says, I was born and raised, my father was a Hindu priest. I'm not buying into that anymore. I'm going to give you a plan that will numb you so that you just don't give a crap that life is so terrible. And so I'm going to give you a way of negating the ill effects of life by making it such that you just don't care. I don't think God cares about that. I think that he would look at Buddha and say, you're just going to cease to exist. I have no reason to put you in Sheol. That's my take on it. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but that's my take on it. Someone like Akiba?
That's a whole other ballgame.
A whole another story. Someone like Paul or Muhammad? Whole another story. They took the lead in perverting and twisting the truth. And they did so in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade, Bah Chebel, with the binding force of religion, with destructive and ruinous cords from Chebel to bind and to pledge, to corrupt and to destroy. And this boisterous and agonizing religious parade was of error, futility, and vanity. Ha Shawa. Of worthless lies, of pagan gods, of idolatrous images, of false and empty promises from Shoah to ravage, devastate, destroy, and ruin. Boy, that is powerful.
Mm.
And it describes religion, This is why God hates religion. They all are based on the idea of promoting error by twisting and distorting. And they do so in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futility, and vanity, of worthless lies, of pagan gods, of idolatrous images. As with the ties that bind on a harness, Amoth, the chains, the fetters which fasten. This is the whole thing. We talked about this just a moment ago.
Yeah,
the Torah's purpose is to liberate. Religion's purpose, politics' purpose, is to enslave, is to bind. Man is fettered by religion and politics. Man is liberated by the Torah. God's intent is to liberate. Man's intent is to confine, is to bind, is to control. So as with the ties that bind on the harness of a cart on the wheels of progress which revolve, going round and round of a wheeled utility and transport vehicle, or of the oxen going round and round on a threshing floor, of sin, of chata. Boy, see, he's pulling out all of the words here. We're going from Awon to Jebel to Chabal to Shawa to both to Agala to chata'a. Chata'a being said, comprised of punishable offenses and ceremonial sacrifices which lead the wrong way. Chata, to mislead, to miss the way, to incur guilt, to forfeit the opportunity. And that really is sin, isn't it? If you want to, you know, sin is a loaded religious term, but from Yahweh's point of view, you forfeited the opportunity. You missed the way, and you forfeited the opportunity. That's a marvelous definition.
No.
And then, so that's describing what man has created. This next part was a little challenging for me until I thought about two things, and I think it's relevant for two reasons. Paul only had one prophecy, didn't he? So was Paul's one and only prophecy.
That,
that he would be there when Yahusha returned.
You got it. The one who says without thinking and out of anxiety over the future, he should hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may know. That's Paul. That's his one and only prophecy. And I think today about like this woman, this sweet lady who had just come from this prophecy conference. Says, you know, I'm really up to speed on what's going to happen in prophecy. Particularly evangelical Christians are just absolutely fascinated, preoccupied with the rapture and the second coming. Just totally and completely preoccupied with it. You know, let him hurry. Going to be proven to be correct. You know, that is the mantra. Now, how many times do you think it was said during the Dark Ages by those being oppressed? Oh God, he'd only come and take us away from all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I want him to swoop down. I want him to accelerate his work, so that we may see it. You know, the purpose of prophecy is just for us to know without actually seeing him, but seeing him and coming to know him through his word. I don't need to see him return to validate anything. He's already validated who he is and what he's offering, and that he inspired these words that we're considering because of the way that they're written and the prophetic implications of them. We don't want him to accelerate his time. We're not asking him to accelerate. We know what his timeline is. He's already told us, so we'll never tell him to accelerate, and we don't need any proof. There is nothing that Yahweh could do, that I would ask him to do, that would serve to validate anything. Yeah, not to say that there's places that I've misunderstood him. I'm sure there are. But I'm not seeking validation. I'm not seeking to... None of us in the covenant are seeking his immediate return. You know, I think last week we talked about Teruah. And that there is no chance whatsoever that it could have been this Teruah for the harvest, and it can't even be next Teruah, because of the fact that the harvest has to follow. Yeah, the Damascus has to fall. Syria has to fall. And the world has to capitulate by giving up the high ground of Yisrael. Until those things happen, we're not being harvested on Teruah.
No.
I don't think there was a single person that listening that said, oh, darn, I'm still going to hope for a more expeditious return. May he hurry. May that be wrong. I want out. None of us.
If he's promised to take care of you, and I might die before that,
and that's fine. And the same thing, or I make it there, then he can use me there to whatever degree, which is small.
There you go.
Fun. You know, it's fun for me. Why would I care?
Right.
I know he's going to do it because he's told us almost everything you'd want to know is in the Torah.
Right. That's right.
And it's easy to figure. And now it's easy to figure out because our perspective is right.
Right. I don't want him to worry. I don't want him to delay.
No.
I know what his schedule is. I'm very fine with his schedule. You know, do I wish that we had more time? For me, no. For my granddaughter, well, yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm.
So, some parts of me say, yeah, I wish we had more time. But it, other than just a fleeting, that is the reality of it. You don't even consider for a moment saying, could you delay or could you speed it up? It's just not even in our vocabulary. You can't know Yahweh and want him to speed up or delay. And I think, Kirk, we actually do have a preference in terms of are we going to have our time here cut short, or are we going to get to fulfill the full opportunity? I think almost all of us, I think our preference would be to be able to fulfill the full opportunity, even though to have it cut short means that we get a faster access to the seventh dimension. I'd still prefer to have the full opportunity, because I think this work is wonderful, and this opportunity will never come again.
Yes.
And so it can never be
repeated. The last are all. I mean, it really is.
The last are all. We've got eternity on the other side, and our time is limited on this side. Which one don't you want to cut short? Particularly since, I wanted to make a point. I've received a number of emails, and recently I have really gotten into translating, and I have distractions like the last 2 days of my school tomorrow. It's my granddaughter's birthday, it's a big birthday celebration. I'm not going to be working on things as well. And so I get a lot of emails, and I even get emails from people I really, really know and like that I don't properly respond to. And, I want to apologize for that. Please don't be angry at me for doing so. It has nothing to do with the individual. Some of the people who send me these emails, I really deeply care for what they have to say. I find really interesting. It's just that there's only so much I can do, and more and more, I've taken the approach of do what really feels. I hate to use the term feeling because this is it's a thinking relationship. But do what your heart's calling you to do. If you're in the midst of translating and somebody's written you a really long email, no matter how much you love that person, you're going to learn something from it. Sometimes you just got to say, I want to get back to translating. I want to make progress on the next chapter. And so I want to apologize for that, but that's just, I think it's part of Yahweh's approach to our teruah, constant teruah mission is, I don't want it to be a burden for you. I want you to do what you want to do, when you want to do it, as much as you want to do, no more than that, and just keep it fun.
My apology to you that I was sent you some stuff, and then I was in the middle of going over 17, 18, and 19, and then all of a sudden it dawned on me, I've got to fill up an hour. You're not going to be there.
Yeah.
But I said, I got to, so everything up to, off to that, So.
I couldn't respond to your request. Once you've really come to know and understand Yahweh, it is Leb. It's incorporated in your heart. That becomes part of the fabric of your life. It guides you in what you ought to do, and do what you should be doing. And that if you're doing the right thing, it's going to be fun, and you're not going to. You ought not ever feel any pressure. You ought not feel any obligation. I want people to know that if I did not answer an email, it isn't because I'm disrespecting you or I don't think the world of you or I didn't think it was really interesting. It, you know, it's just
24 hours in a day.
We are limited, and I don't think Yahweh wants us to spend the 24 hours in a day doing this all the time. I think He designed us for downtime, and He wants us to enjoy relationships. You know, He would not have created Yahweh for Adam if He wanted to monopolize our time. He doesn't. No good relationship has your time totally monopolized. You've got to have other interests. So I just wanted to share that. But I think that the second part of this is all focused on the desperate need of Christians to reinforce their faith, of them wanting their God has to come back soon, of Paul trying to create credibility for himself by saying, yeah, we're all going to be here when he returns. And let me tell you all about it. Knowing full well that when he's dead, who's going to hold him accountable? Right? What's it going to be for him? But that's not our nature. We don't have these kind of needs. My guess is, Kirk and JB, you've never felt the obligation to prove your devotion to Yahweh by doing some level of work, of preparation.
No, this is we do it out of fun.
Yeah,
it does take some time, but we do it out of fun. I'm sure.
You do it out of fun.
It is work, but it's great work.
Yeah. You know, and you know, you prepared for today's program, and you got the contribution to Molly. And so, first thing you told me is that your wife thought it was informative. You did a good job.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's the one who suggested Molly. She said, because I was sitting there saying, you know, Scott won't have much time to talk at all.
Right.
Because he's working two shows, and I'm going to just sit there, and I don't want to just sound so dry. You know, it's so much more fun when there's somebody there to talk to. Even if you read all these passages for hours and we just nodded back and forth, at least you know we're there and we're talking. You're talking to someone physically.
Right. So, what was your reaction when Terry said, "I think you did a great job"?
Well, I was excited as you.
Right.
I mean, that's all my flaws, and she, you know, but she was nice.
Right.
Molly was wonderful, and so
and
that
first thing you did is tell me how wonderful you thought Molly was.
Yeah, she was. She did well.
Right, and
she was quite nervous, you know. She said, "I said, don't be nervous."
Right.
Yeah.
That's the reward.
Yeah.
The reward is going through this and having someone benefit from it. Yeah. So, you know, I appreciate the teaching. I learned something from it. I had not considered that before. Just anything of, you know, I learned something. That was a meaningful way to have spent an hour and a half. Makes it worthwhile. Are you looking for the praise? Absolutely not. Is it enjoyable just doing it? Yeah, if you didn't hear anything from anybody, yes, it would be. But there's a pleasure about sharing something with people that you care about and having occasionally somebody that you care about saying, hey, I want to thank you. I learned something from that. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was your experience. I don't think you felt at any point, uh-oh, I don't want to disappoint God here. I better go in and get this done. I better do a good job or the people are going to be questioning my devotion.
Well, no, I don't think like that.
I
stumble on my word and be ill-prepared. I do want to be prepared, and then you give it your best shot, and that's it. So.
Yes. The preparation, Yahweh expects us to be prepared. Like I said today, you know, here I came to this right out of flight school, so I didn't read through what we were going to cover today. That does not make me ill-prepared.
No, you actually wrote this.
Yeah, I wrote this. Translate.
I should be rather familiar with the material.
I think you knew the material pretty well.
Right. I spent a month on this. And not all that long ago, because we jumped ahead from chapter 10 to chapter 14 because of what's coming up in a future show of where this is leading, is that there was so much reinforcement in this, because, you know, where Terry, your wife, said, hey, Kirk, I think you did a good job. That was really good.
Well, no, she said the show was very good. She thought the show was good.
Yeah, okay.
I don't
and, and you acknowledge that Molly's really good. That ought to make him feel good. When Yahoo says, you know, I raised a banner, and you realize he's talking about us,
yeah,
that makes me feel really, really good.
Yeah,
you know, somebody I care about and respect. And, you know, he wouldn't say, hey, we did a great job. He didn't say that. He didn't say, hey, the show was really good. He didn't say, yeah, those books, man, those are righteous. No, but he said, you know, I ripped it up, this banner, and wow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to make
that's
of it.
That's a wowie.
That's a wow. Yeah. And he prefaces it all in context by highlighting the things that are unique to what we have learned.
Yeah.
And everything that he said about this banner, about calling out of Doad as the single most important person for us to acknowledge,
mm-hmm,
about Yahweh's use of metaphors with the vineyard and what when he talks about things like grapes, what he's really referring to and the nourishment of his word, and that everything boils down to his family, and that man has planted weeds and corrupted that message. And you go through the entire process of that God's really angry at the leaders of religion, and that religion is perverted and corrupt. Every bit of the context
is totally what you've been writing, what we've been writing
right
about, or you've been writing about
right
for 15 years,
right,
and we've been
talking
about.
Right. Right. And he'll even talk about the Torah and how important the Torah is and all of this. And how the bottom line is the thing that has separated man from God is our ignorance of him and our unwillingness to think. And that has created the broad path for who? Shaul. How many others out there have called out Shaul by name and said that that he's the problem? You know, so
nobody.
Every context of it says, yeah, I mean, no one else in the world's going to know this, but you're going to know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've set this out in a way that you'll recognize it when you read it, and that's the intent. You know, you don't need somebody else to know that it's your banner that, and you know, it's our banner in the sense that all we're doing is conveying his testimony.
Well, we're
in our
hanging up,
on
we're
it
putting up his banner.
Yeah, yeah, but it's still his words we're putting up. But
yeah,
you know, we've put in a lot of energy into conveying them, and when he lifts them up, we don't need somebody outside of our community to care about it, to acknowledge it. Not looking for that. And it would be impossible for them to know it. But for our family, we ought to know it. We ought to care about it. We ought to be happy about it. You know?
Mm-hmm. That's
even better than having your wife say it's a good show. Yeah.
Let me ask you two guys a question.
We're putting her a notch below Yahweh, but that's...
Let me ask
I like Terry. I like Terry a lot. I know she means the world to you, and I know she was instrumental in us coming together. We wouldn't be together without Terry.
Yes, indeed.
And Terry and I've had a lot of good interchanges, but I do rank Yahweh acknowledgement.
Good, thank you.
Ahead of Terry's, and I don't think Terry is probably bothered by that at all.
No, I don't think so. I want to ask you, when you were reading about the war part, both of you guys, when you read about the war part, this is a warning. What went wrong when there was a world that didn't have a king? There was a Yehudim that didn't have a king in Israel. What was, I know,
when they
I
had,
can read
when
it.
When they
it,
had the judges, when they had...
Yeah, what was so bad with this that they... I understand you say, well, they're jealous because there are other kings.
Why?
Gosh. Why do you want to leave that life and be under a king, under an army?
Particularly if Yahweh then comes to say, hey, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me.
Yeah.
And this is the consequence of them rejecting me. And he goes through, this is what the king's going to do to you. That's abysmal. No.
Yeah.
Why would you continue to do that? Well, only two reasons. You're ignorant. You're irrational. right?
Well, you have to be. I mean, that's just ludicrous.
You want to depend on the case as opposed to depending on Yahweh. You're ignorant and you're irrational. And
just hard to fathom. Yeah, just hard to fathom, isn't it? I mean, I can't think of any situation where I would have chosen a team if I could avoid it.
I am really glad that I was an ordained ruling elder of the Presbyterian Church and taught evangelism and taught Bible studies and led public prayers and all of that, because having been so disgustingly wrong, it created what modicum of empathy I could muster. And when I say that, my modicum of empathy, Yahweh's message is so wonderful. It's so clearly articulated, so clearly proven, irrefutably proven, and the religious myths are so obviously untrue and so easily disproved that it's very difficult, once you come to know the truth and you come to recognize the lies, it's exceedingly difficult to show compassion for those who continue to cling to the lie once they're presented the truth. And so the only modicum of empathy I can muster is the realization that I was once among them and was blinded and fooled. You're talking about why they did this. It's hard to have any respect for them. And as I say,
They had Samuel right there. I mean, my gosh, what do you want?
Yeah.
Hey, you have a walk with Samuel.
Right, speaking directly for him.
Yeah.
Through him.
But
they didn't actually blame it on Samuel. You know, they're all weasels. They said, you know, your sons don't walk in the same path that you do.
Yeah, so? They're corrupt, therefore. We need something better deal.
Okay. So? It's like saying, okay, you know, I've got two sons. One of my two sons doesn't walk in the same path. So does that make me any less aware of what Yahweh said?
No.
It's true. I'm not able to convince my eldest. He's a great young man. We have a wonderful relationship. I love him dearly. He has gone his own way, and he's not religious. He's not political. And he knows that religious and political schemes are all crud. He's not willing to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. I am incapable of convincing him otherwise. I've tried. I could look at myself and say, well, you're just a failure. You know, if you're really good at this, you'd be able to...
He's got free will. I mean,
you can't coerce people. Right. You know, in Yosha's family...
He has great brains, so we obviously can figure
it out. We know about Mom, and he dearly loves Mom. And we know about Jacob. Do we know about anybody else? Do we ever hear anything about anybody else?
No.
Does he ever speak about this glowing relationship he had with his dad? Does he ever speak about his ongoing relationship with any of his other brothers? If Yosha couldn't do it, I don't think I should feel bad that I can't do it.
Oh. Well, that's always the answer. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said about apologies for emails and all, because I've read on some of the Facebook sites when I was doing my investigation, I was being condemned as the jerk of all jerks because somebody write me an email and I wouldn't respond to it. And, yeah, I guess that is jerky, you know. I mean, people take the time to write and I don't respond to all of them. It has nothing to do with the individual, but I'm going to cop out here. What did Yosha do every time that people started asking a bunch of questions? They tried to pursue
the Torah
100% of the time. So after saying, you know, the answers in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, what did he do?
He walked away.
He walked away and faded into the woodwork. He walked away. There's only so much that he could handle. He recharged and reengaged. He wasn't 24/7. He didn't try to interact with them all the time. He wasn't trying to save all of them. He walked away. I think that's, I've said this before. I don't think we're called to follow Yahusha as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't think we can, and there's no purpose of us trying to complete a sacrifice or to model him and Pesach, Matzah, and Pekodim. We just enjoy being a beneficiary. Dode we can follow. But that is not to say that there aren't portions of what Yahusha said and did that we can't benefit from if we try to apply to our own lives. And one of those things is that he didn't try 24/7 to convince people. He backed off. And for the most part, he didn't engage them. He responded to them. The only place I can think about where Yahusha, unprovoked by a question, just unleashed the floodgates was the, what's called the Sermon on the Mount, Matanya 5, 6, and 7. Otherwise, he's responding to people's questions. Even the Olivet Discourse is a response to a question.
Yeah, the disciples ask him.
Right. The 23rd chapter of Matanya, where he's just lambasting the religious figures, they have hounded him, and he's now responding and condemning them. So, you know, I think there are some examples. He observed the Mikre. He turned to the Father for answers. He looked to the Father. It's like the Christian, the first thing that he asked when I was talking about the Torah and Hebrew and Yahweh. Well, then, you know, what do you have to say about Jesus Christ? Why are you asking? What does it have to do with the price of potatoes? We're talking about God. Why do you turn to a diminished manifestation as if what I think about
a better manifestation
is more, yeah, is more important than what I know about God himself?
When he pointed to the
Father. More important.
Right. Yeah. One's important, the other one's not. That's why I thought it was so interesting, this that not only didn't have the prophecy of a virgin, which, by the way, calls into question that portion of Matanya, because Matanya says, you know, be born of a virgin as it is predicted and by the prophets. And no, it doesn't predict that, that he's going to be born of a virgin. So that is an error. And then it talks about him and not knowing things and not existing at certain times in the And there's a real possibility that, and I know there's some things that make it sound otherwise, but there's really no reason for Yahusha to exist in the seventh dimension. There's no reason for Yahusha to exist prior to the universe being created.
No,
there's
I
no
agree
purpose
there.
For a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, with exception of interacting with us and on occasion fulfilling the Mikre promises. There's no purpose. I don't think right now there's any purpose for him whatsoever. And I hope I'm not overstating this, but he had a purpose. He fulfilled his purpose.
Mm-hmm. And he fulfilled the purpose.
Right. Which enables us to know and come to the Father. I think what he did was stunningly magnificent. But he did what he had to do. That's why he left.
Yes. He came for that sole purpose. He completed his task, and then he returned.
So so what happens then to his to the soul? I mean, the soul that went into Sheol.
I think it's Yahweh's soul. I think there are two things unique about Yahusha.
Mm-hmm.
One is Yahusha's soul is Yahweh's soul. I don't care how Yahusha was conceived physically. It doesn't. His physical body only served as the Pesach lamb, and it was destroyed. So how his physical body came into being, I don't care. Whether or not it was of a virgin or the old-fashioned one, it doesn't mean diddly to me. I do not care.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has nothing, no impact.
And he was declared perfect, so that's not an issue.
And by the way, I think as a young person, prior to the time, because there's two things that made him unique. I think it's Yahweh's soul. I think it is that when the set-apart spirit came upon him at the time that he began his mission, I think from the time he began his mission to the time that he fulfilled it, that he was, now, the term, and there's two terms in Hebrew for perfect, but I think that the likely term that Yahweh would have used is tzedak, that he's right.
Yeah, we talked
correct.
About that today.
Absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right and correct. And only perfect in the sense that the Passover lamb is
declared perfect. No, the priest
yeah, declared,
lamb.
Right, declared perfect as opposed to, there's no such thing as a perfect lamb.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the lamb is declared perfect, so he declared him perfect to be the perfect Passover lamb. And you know, I don't think you know that he committed any of the normal kinds of sins that that Dode did, for example. So he was able to for Yahweh to declare him perfect. But I think the two things that make him unique is that when the set apart spirit came upon him in the Jordan River, that was a much more all encompassing application of Yahweh's set apart spirit than what we, it's not that what we can have access to, but what we actually access.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we were as robust in the set apart spirit as he was, then anything that we requested would materialize. And it would be, we would have extraordinary powers.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I don't want those powers. I don't want the responsibility of having those kind of powers. But I think we would be in a different place. And now I will tell you, occasionally, I will make a request on behalf of the influence of the set apart spirit. And a miraculous event will transpire. And I never share them because I don't want to create the impression that I'm unique in that way. But I'm quite convinced that the two things that set Yahusha apart was it was Yahweh's soul. And so there isn't a separate Yahusha, it is Yahweh's soul. And that the application of the set apart spirit on him, because it was Yahweh's soul, was far more complete than it is on the rest of us. And it's not because we can't have it that complete, but we just don't.
Yeah.
You know, we're just not quite that open, not quite that bold.
And we don't need it for this purpose either.
We don't need it for this purpose.
Yeah.
And Yahweh's not a show-off. So, you know, if you can do something that's extraordinary because of the power of the Spirit, Yahweh doesn't want you doing it.
Yeah.
You know, Yahweh wants to be known and respected and accepted based upon his testimony.
Yeah.
And if his testimony doesn't resonate with you, he does not want to impress you with miracles. And so, there is a, and we ought not be asking for things that are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
I asked for what Solomon asked for.
Yeah, that's the one thing you want. Wisdom. Good judgment. Discernment. The ability to understand. Yeah. You know, and I think about what it is that has helped us create an ensign, a sign, a banner that Yahweh would lift up. And that was a propensity to understand, an aptitude to understand, willingness and an openness, a dedication to understand. Because understanding is infinitely more powerful than knowing.
Yeah.
Well, and knowing is infinitely more powerful than believing. And I think that is the unique attribute that we have applied to his testimony that has made what we're doing here extraordinary. It's the ability to transition from knowledge to understanding. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask you one quickly about next week for observations.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going?
Yeah, well, do you want to go to Sukha, or do you want to, we've covered Sukha a bunch of times, or do you want to just continue with Revelation or Chapter 5?
We're kind of spread out at the moment, so I mean,
we're in three different places.
Wherever you want
my preference is to, yeah. Well,
see,
my preference.
I may not be, but I don't want to talk on there, but I just...
Yeah, you might be visiting. Be visiting for Sukha. My preference would be to continue to, I'd like to complete Yashaya, the 14th chapter as it's related to observations, which covers Yashaya chapter 5.
Where we are now?
Yeah, I'd like to continue with that, and then I want to return to observations 10, where we were in the midst of exposing the history of
Bible translation.
Yes, because once we get through that, there's some really interesting and pertinent things in chapter 11, 12, and 13 that go mm-hmm. through the terms and conditions of the covenant and the test that Yahweh lays out for us and how we meet that test. There's some really meaty things for us to learn, and then we'll turn to Yashaya, chapters 6 and 7 of Yashaya, which are in the 15th chapter of Observations, after all of that. That's kind of what I'd like to...
what materials to have read.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, we've got... And at this point, I'm able to create new chapters and translate chapters of Yashaya at a pace that's faster than we're covering them on the radio program.
Well, I guess.
So that's a good thing. Yeah, the last few chapters have actually gone pretty quickly. So that's unique. I'm usually painfully slow, but we've been making good progress here recently. Yeah. All right, my friends. Good night. Happy Yom Kippur. Happy Yom Kippur.
Enjoy Kippur.
Yeah, thank you. My daughter's, my granddaughter's second birthday party tomorrow, so I'm going to be Dolly's in the kitchen. And my granddaughter has come up with this great love for clocks that move and make sounds. So our gift to her is an animated clock that plays some 30 different songs. Every time a clock chimes, she just runs to it, and she's just enamored with clocks. So, yeah, not very often would you give as a birthday gift to a two-year-old toddler an animated musical clock. But she dearly loves clocks.
Oh.
So we'll have fun tomorrow when she opens her clock. Pretty silly, right?
Yeah.
Hey, whatever makes her happy.
Watch the clock the rest of the day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, she'll be, there's a mode button on this clock where, you know, at every 15 minutes it'll chime, and then, of course, it does its whole routine. It's a rhythm clock, so the dial opens up, and the numbers spin, and there's a Swarovski crystal little thing at the bottom that spins around, and lights go on and off, and it's totally animated, and it plays these songs, and, you know, she'll push that mode button 100 times.
Wear it out.
Oh, well, yeah. I love the cuckoo. The cuckoo clock, though, that, you know, actually goes cuckoo. That little bird that comes out. That's a favorite, too, but the problem with those is they're just too fragile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You touch one of those and it's over. Okay. Time is of total.
Well, enjoy.
Yeah. All right, we'll do. Happy
All right, guys.
For him.
Talk to you next
time. Thank you. Thank you, Kirk and Molly, for doing the earlier
show. Well, I know she was enjoyed doing it then, and I certainly did. So
I can't wait to.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
Yeah, good deal. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.